poking out of two rows of blue waves. Most every town in the country, no matter how tiny, has a public pool, typically outdoors, often geothermally heated for year-round use, and many towns have several options of varying size and temperature. Because of Heimai's unusually high winds, Vespenire's offerings include an indoor lap pool. Every day, Alan tells me, the swimming hall sees multiple generations of Icelanders from all ages and backgrounds, the before-work swimmers, elementary schoolers during gym class, retirees coming for their recreation. A few months before my arrival in Iceland, I'd read in the Icelandic newspapers about a group of 30 ocean swimmers preparing for a swim expedition in Reykjavik. Who should show up to join the swim but the president of Iceland, Guðni Jóhannesson? Local reporters observed that President Guðni shrugged off his unexpected appearance by welcoming the swimmers and declaring that he doesn't doubt the health benefits of taking a dip in cold ocean water. At the end of the swim, the swimmers were invited to the presidential residence to warm themselves up in the president's own hot pool. Alan says the ubiquitous hot pools throughout the country are what make Icelandic swimming special. After we do our laps inside the Vespenir Hall, we meander outdoors across the snow-covered ground so I can choose one of three hot pools in which to have a chat. Temperature range, hot, very hot, extremely hot. Sveni Gudmundsson, the other organizer of Guðlaugsund, climbs down from his lifeguard station to join our conversation. He tells me that the pool will host disco nights for the local teenagers, during which he pipes popular music through the outdoor speakers. At the moment, we are listening to the Rolling Stones, but the teens don't know who the Rolling Stones are, he says, rolling his eyes. The pool is how Icelanders survive the long, dark winter. We discuss the evolution of Guðlaugsund, which started like this. On the first anniversary of the trawling accident in March 1985, 20 students from the island's navigation college swam 6 kilometers in a pool, fully clothed, under the supervision of the then headmaster, Fridrik Asmundsson, who had a reputation for strictness. No flotation devices, no holding on to the side of the pool. In those early years, the number of students participating in any given event went as high as 70. But mostly held steady at 2 or 3 dozen, and the emphasis was on safety. Beginning in 2000, the swim was open to the public. High school students swam relays, local businesses sponsored their employees, and the island swim team always had a healthy contingent. Fishing captains and other seamen were also well represented. Some swimmers asked to participate remotely, from nearby Reykjavik and as far away as Tibet and Vietnam. Almost everyone had an island or Icelandic connection. Sveni's father is the captain of a fishing trawler, and he himself spent 5 winters on the sea. He tells me that he swims for both the memory of Guðlaugur, who did this, and all the guys who didn't make it. We still think this swim is a reminder for everybody for safety, of equipment, and also of swimming. He and Alan have swum numerous times, both individually and as part of the sports center's relay team. Alan is unfailingly upbeat in his encouragement of first-time swimmers of all ages and abilities. The aim of the swim these days, he explains, is to have people achieve something they would not have thought they could accomplish themselves. Months before, over the course of my first phone conversation with Alan about Guðlaugsund, I somehow ended up agreeing to swim in it. And if you can't finish the 6 kilometers, he cheerfully told me then, I'll finish it for you. Later at the swimming hall, I watch one young man stroll past the hot pools for a dip in the cold pool, the only outdoor pool that's unheated. The air temperature is 26 degrees, and there's ice on the ground. 45-degree water is the kind of cold that is hard to imagine. To feel it for myself, I cautiously inch down the icy ramp, swearing under my breath at every step. What does it feel like? Piercing and urgent. My cells scream for me to get out. Though I will later swim the full 6 kilometers of Guðlaugsund, it occurs to me that this plunge is probably the closest I'll ever come to feeling something of what Guðlaugur felt on his swim. Like any good Icelander, Guðlaugur often swam in the sea as a child. He and a friend would pinball from one side of the island to the other, swimming near the harbor, then near the lighthouse. It would take less than an hour for the pair of 10-year-olds to walk from town to a sweeping crescent-shaped black sand beach on the south end of Heimai. They thought nothing of it, until his friend's father got wind of it and put limits on their unsupervised ocean jaunts. Guthlaugr and I are driving south past this very same crescent-shaped beach, toward the island's lighthouse, in his maroon Ford pickup truck. On the night of his swim, in the inky darkness and surging waves, the lighthouse is what guided him home. This evening, it's not quite dusk yet. The sun is low in the sky, bathing everything in a rose-gold tint, including Guthlaugr's big, silvery beard. I ask him if swimming still feels joyful to him. By way of an answer, he tells me about the time he and his wife went to the Westfjords region of Iceland, where they stayed at a place with a little infinity pool by the sea. Being in that pool, he says, was like being the sea itself, and it felt good. We get out of his truck at the lighthouse and walk a little way over a field of parched, snow-covered grass. Installed on the clifftop is a waist-high circular memorial. On its surface is a weathered, coppery disc etched with a map of the island, with markings of our current location, the place where the boat went down, and the distance back to shore. The wind is wicked and sharp, whipping my hair into my face. Guthlaugr raises a hand and points southeast toward the sea. Much of the time, when something goes wrong on a fishing boat, everyone drowns, Guthlaugr says, so there is no one to say what happened. But when we were holding on to the keel that night, we said that if one of us made it, we would tell them. He pauses. I was there to tell. He faithfully kept his promise with the early decades of Guthlaugsund, and with his vocal support for auto-deploying life rafts for all of Iceland's fishing fleet. During my few days visiting the island, we go for several long drives, looping around on empty roads that trace the contours of the stark red rock landscape. The local population balloons in summer, when 1/5 of the world's puffins come back to roost on the Vestmannaeyjar archipelago, along with the thousands of human tourists who come to see them. In the winter months, though, tourism is largely dormant, and the island is returned to its year-round residents. In this small town place, Guthlaugr explains, driving is the easiest way to have a conversation uninterrupted by someone he knows. Guthlaugr is recognized everywhere in Iceland. Well, you see, I don't blend in, he says wryly. At 6'4", he is a broad, striking man, with shoulder-length curly silver hair and a full beard edged with dark. If you Googled Hemingway and fisherman, you'd expect him, or someone who looks like him, to emerge in the search results. We find out there is a French film crew in the area, out on a boat, making a documentary about him. Guthlaugr doesn't speak with them, but he knows they're there. He gets phone calls from journalists in Japan. When he visits his children and grandchildren in Reykjavik, people often come up to him in public to shake his hand and ask how his life has been. On one evening drive, we see the lights of 2 cod fishing vessels returning to the harbor. I insist that we stop at a fish restaurant so he can let me buy him dinner. On our way out, a smiling woman with smartly cut hair and stylish black boots approaches, and I assume it's another admirer. My sister, he says shyly, introducing us. What I learn is that he lives on the same street where he grew up. His wife, Maria, grew up on that street too. They live in the house where she was born. One morning, they invite me over for brunch, and Maria shows me the vegetable plots in their tidy backyard garden. Behind the garden, Guthlaugr builds things, like a tall wood stove fashioned from part of a fishing trawler. He is busy with work, family, friends, travels. Once, in the year after his accident, he swam in Lake George in upstate New York, the lake my husband and I swam across the morning after we were married. Somehow, learning this makes us feel like kin to one another. On one wall of his home, in a place of honor, there is a framed piece of art made by his grandson, Daniel, when Daniel was in kindergarten. It's a brightly colored sand painting of a blue ocean background, a red fishing boat, and next to it, the dark figure of a man swimming in the water. When Guthlaugr and Maria show this picture to me, I am surprised by the tears that suddenly prick my eyes. What can Guthlaugr tell us? Is the question at hand. But perhaps the more important corollary is, will Guthlaugr tell us what we want to know? I began to realize that the stories other swimmers told about Guthlaugr were just as revealing about human nature as anything the man himself could tell me. And I came to understand that I had to visit Heimai to witness both kinds of stories for myself. Alan Ellison introduces me to Sigrun Haldorsdottir, a young teacher who moved from Vestmannaeyjar to Reykjavik and is now a swim coach. 3 years ago, she began to lead her charges in swimming Guðlaugsund. Sigrun started swimming Guðlaugsund when she was 12 years old. She is now 30. Even after I stopped swim team, I do the swim every year on my own to keep it alive, Sigrun tells me when I phone her up. It's a big deal, what he did. She teaches her swim team about Guthlaugr's achievement. After the children complete their swims, Alan mails them signed certificates from Vestmannaeyjar. Hearing from them illuminates the everyman side of the saga. Guthlaugr's story tells us that we swim for survival, but also that we swim for remembrance. After the accident, from his hospital bed, Guthlaugr spoke with a television interviewer about his experience. In the footage, his face is young, cherubic. He wears a faint, wispy mustache and a white hospital gown. His eyes downcast, he talks about the seagulls who circled above his head as he swam. He spoke to them and asked them to get help if they could. All night long, they stayed above him. The Icelandic doctor who conducted the medical studies became a good friend. A few years ago, they met each other over coffee. The doctor told Guthlaugr that he'd just been to a medical conference on hypothermia. Many of the other doctors had the same question about his most famous patient. Is he all right in the head? They asked. When people go through something so big, they can go crazy. Guthlaugr told the doctor that he was fine. He joked that he couldn't get any crazier than he already was. Guthlaugr explains to me that during his recovery, his father sat in a chair next to his bed at the hospital and didn't leave his side for a month. Guthlaugr felt compelled to talk. He would relay the drama of the accident over and over again, and his father would listen. I think that is why I am okay now, he tells me. My father was a very good listener. It's his father's startlingly beautiful cursive handwriting that fills the pages of the Guthlaugsund logbook, recounting the events of that night with care, and recording the swims and their participants year after year for posterity. At the Vestmannaeyjar History Museum, the clothes Guthlaugr wore the night of his swim are hanging in a glass case. His mother saved them and carefully put them away. Eventually, his wife donated them to the museum. We all want to survive. We all have a will to do it, says Helga Hallbergiusdottir, the director of the museum, and a friend of Guthlaugr's. But I think that conversation at the top of the boat, before it sank, they promised one another that if someone somehow survives, that he will work to make things safer and better, to save others. That's what kept him going. Guthlaugr didn't choose to swim for his life. But if there's meaning in what happened, perhaps it's that his survival enabled by swimming encouraged others to learn to swim too. I ask Helga why she thinks the islanders still swim Guthlaugsund so faithfully, year in and year out, nearly 35 years later. She says that his accomplishment is a reminder of all those who did not survive, and of our own inevitable mortality. We have not forgotten what he was able to do, she says, and we respect him very much for it. The emphasis on swimming instruction that began on this island, by extension, is now baked into the cultural DNA of Iceland itself. The pool, Helga tells me with a smile, is our pub. After all these years, and after all his reservations, why did Guthlaugr agree to talk to me? It becomes clear, in the few days we spend together, that it was because the cultural DNA that lives in his fellow Icelanders lives in him too. He makes it a point to tell me this story. 3 weeks before, he'd gone to the hardware store in town. On his way in from the parking lot, he ran into someone he knew, a woman who would be turning 90 years old that weekend. He bid her a good day. She looked up at him without recognition. "Do we know each other?" I said. "Don't you remember me?" She was his swimming teacher, the one who taught him how to swim in the old swimming pool 50 years before. He doesn't often go out of his way to remind people who he is, but he wanted her to remember that she'd taught him to swim. I said, "Well, it turned out well for me." He pauses and smiles, and then she understood who I was. I wake early in the morning for Guðlaugsund. There's fresh snow on the ground, and I crunch through it on my walk to the pool in the 6 a.m. gloom. 5 swimmers, 4 men and 1 woman, are already in the water, having braved the pre-dawn cold at 4:30 a.m. so that they could complete the swim and still get to work on time. Alan and Svenny are manning the officials' table. They introduce me to the partners and friends and co-workers sitting on the pool deck. Some are counting laps. Some are there to keep company. More swimmers show up, ready to go. Under my bare feet, the red tile floor is clammy and damp. As I wait for a lane to open up, I think about how everyone is here for the same thing. The routine tradition of it is reminiscent of Thanksgiving Day turkey trots and 4th of July fun runs. On a Wednesday morning, in the second week of March, in this small-town Icelandic pool, we are paying homage to a man and to a country's history through a national pastime. It's not quite a national holiday. Instead of hot dogs and fireworks, there's hot coffee and 240 laps. In a modest, mundane way, this is simply how a community binds itself together. But in the doggedness, there is something bigger and more beautiful than the 30 people in the swimming hall. When I do get in the water, I find that the swim is something that largely takes place inside my head. I settle in, and eventually I notice things. At 2 kilometers, I watch the elementary school headmaster in the next lane haul himself out and head off to work. At 3 kilometers, I smell fish when Svenny opens the outside door. The fish meal factory is up and running for the day. At 4 kilometers, the sun has risen enough so that it starts to filter through the skylights and side windows, a glorious late winter lemon yellow. It plays across the lanes and down into the water where I swim. At 5 kilometers, I start to feel giddy. I am reminded of the warning posted by the hot pools. Caution, excessive use of hot tubs may cause dysphoria. With 8 laps to go, I poke my head up and do the breaststroke, double-checking my distance with Alan, who's counting my laps. I finish with 1 lap each of butterfly, backstroke, breaststroke, and freestyle, just to mix it up, just to show I am still in good form. 1 hour and 50 minutes after I begin, I'm done. I text Guðlaugur to let him know that I have completed the swim in his honor. It gives me great pleasure to be able to do this. He calls from work to caution me, in an avuncular way, to make sure I get some rest. "It is a long swim, after all," he says. I think about how surreal it is that he's the one telling me that. Then I walk back through the snow to my hotel and take a nap. Visiting the Icelandic coast, contemplating the sea from the perch of a pool, it is swimming as liturgy. The rite of swimming enables us to endure many things through a communal call and response of story as well as practice. I believe in the power of how we pass down that tradition. In many ways, swimming and family were intertwined for me from the start. It's my own origin story. In the summer of 1968, my parents met in a swimming pool in Hong Kong. For one hot moment, they were the cliché incarnate. He was the bronzed lifeguard, she was the bikini-clad beauty with long black hair and big, serious eyes. When I flip through snapshots of that time, I can hardly bear their prettiness, their slim-limbed stances, the way they looked at each other with such longing. Such longing, of course, rarely lasts. That they stayed married as many years as they did, until my older brother and I were safely in college. is complicated by periods of living apart, blowout fights, silent treatments. The only things they had in common, it seemed, were their youthful looks, us kids, and swimming. People who know my brother and me laugh when we tell them our parents met at the pool. We began to swim at ages 6 and 5 at the outdoor recreation center near our home on Long Island. As the precursor to a life in the water, the final mileage not yet marked, I spent summer mornings taking lessons with Andy while our mother swam laps in the next lane. Her favorite stroke was breaststroke. As we paddled alongside, we could see her head popping up for breath at regular intervals, her legs executing a powerful frog kick under the calm surface. In the afternoons, my father would sometimes join us, and we'd head down to Jones Beach. We drove the 8 miles along the causeway from our house, leapfrogging across the little islands in the bay that separate fish-shaped Long Island from the skinny barrier island that is the beach. On the other side of that barrier island was the vast viridian green expanse of the Atlantic Ocean. We rolled down the windows and let the sea air blast through our eggshell-colored 1978 Volvo station wagon. During low tide, we pinched our noses against that stink that rose from the exposed mudflats below. Most visits, my mother and father would begin with a jog alone together by the water's edge. At the end of the run, they'd jump into the ocean, and my father would finish with a solo swim beyond the shore break. This was his comfort zone. Every stroke pulled him further from us, back in time to the days spent free diving and spearfishing with his father and brother off the subtropical beaches of Hong Kong Island. My mother would come back and sit on the towel, and we'd look up every now and again, shading our eyes, searching out my father's splashing figure in the waves. Swimming out there was a grown-up thing. Each year, I hopefully inched closer and closer to it. My parents seemed so happy in the water. In real life, on land, they were often at odds. She was the stern, responsible parent who ran the household and paid the bills. He got to be the fun one, the artist who worked in his downstairs studio and stayed up until 4 a.m. They never talked about the things that mattered, why he felt lonely in America, or what she missed of life outside of raising kids. It was a wonder they agreed on swimming. But at those moments on the beach or in the pool with us, I believed they still loved each other. In the water, the rigid roles that were so defined at home disappeared. The allure of swimming, already powerful, was amplified by its association with the tenuous thing that still held my parents together. We were a family, and then we weren't. No one in our foursome kept swimming except for me. I swam through the divorce. I swam through college. I swam from Alcatraz on a dare. I swam as rehab from knee surgery. I swam across a lake at my wedding. I swam to an Italian monastery and back to help settle someone else's bet. I swam through a miscarriage and on each of the days before my 2 sons were born. 3 decades of swimming, of chasing equilibrium, have kept my head firmly above water. Swimming can enable survival in many ways beyond the physical. Survival stories like those of Guthlaugr and ancient swimmers like the Moken have to do with me as a swimmer too. Reading the Australian philosopher Damon Young helps me to understand the importance of the sublime in our experience of swimming. 18th century philosophers explained the sublime and its power in the meeting of nature's opposing forces and ideas. Pain and pleasure, terror and awe, fear and exhilaration, life and death. When we swim today, writes Young, that euphoria comes from the passions of survival without the desperate need to survive. We come closer to the acutely vivid experience of life itself. We evolve. Why we swim does, too. Well-being. How nice it would be to die swimming toward the sun. Le Corbusier. One of the best marathon swimmers in the world today began swimming as an adult in 2009 to rehab a leg she almost lost to amputation. A high-heel shoe was the culprit, Kim Chambers tells me. It led to a nasty fall down the stairs outside of her San Francisco apartment. She remembers the doctors telling her this. We saved your leg, but we don't know what, if any, functionality you'll ever have. It took her 2 years to learn how to walk again. It took much less time to discover that she is freakishly gifted at long-distance swimming. You could say that Kim is the best swimmer in the world whom you don't know. 7 months after she first got into a pool after her accident, she swam from Alcatraz to San Francisco, cutting across the choppy waters and fierce currents of San Francisco Bay. She now holds multiple world records for distance swimming, including one she set in 2015 by becoming the first woman to swim solo from the Farallon Islands to the Golden Gate Bridge. A 30-mile journey that began with her slipping into pitch-dark waters just before midnight in the notorious Red Triangle of Great White Sharks. It took her just over 17 hours. Under the watchful eye of her boat crew, she faced nausea, high winds, and the perpetual menace of sharks. Ever thoughtful, Kim did her laundry and folded it neatly the night before. She didn't want to leave a mess in case she didn't make it back. She was only the sixth person in history to complete the Ocean's Seven, the open water swimming equivalent of the Seven Summits. This consists of the English Channel, the Strait of Gibraltar, the Molokai Channel, Lake Tahoe, the Cook Strait in New Zealand, the Suguru Strait in Japan, and the North Channel from Ireland to Scotland, after which she went into toxic shock from hundreds of jellyfish stings. One gray, drizzly December morning, I join Kim for a swim in San Francisco Bay. I want to get a sense of the way that swimming is a daily practice for her and how it got that way. The water temperature is a brisk 53 degrees Fahrenheit, the air 48. The days I don't get in are the days I don't feel right, she tells me as we contemplate the bay from Aquatic Park, the sandy beach behind the Dolphin Club, one of the premier open water swimming and rowing clubs in the world. It was founded in 1877. Its neighbor, the South End Rowing Club, is even older. It was founded in 1873. Both are institutions with numerous Olympians on their century and a half old membership rolls. They are fierce yet friendly rivals, and Kim is a member of both clubs. I'm a middle child, she says sheepishly, by way of explanation. For many swimmers, the act of swimming is a tonic, in that old-fashioned sense of the word. It is a restorative, a stimulant, undertaken for a feeling of vigor and well-being. The word tonic comes from the Greek tonikos, of or for stretching. About a dozen people are in the water already, swimming against the unlikely backdrop of ships and industrial docks and tall-masted sailboats. Rain pocks the steely surface of the water, a liquid mercury mirror of the sky above. There is an expansiveness here. It's not too hard to think of this kind of swimming as stretching the mind as well as the body. Kim stops to greet Stella, the sopping wet dog of a fellow Dolphin Club member. The dog yelps and jumps, licking Kim's face and hands in excitement. Me, I can't stop shivering, even in a 4mm neoprene wetsuit. Kim is unfazed. 5'10" and willowy, with a high megawatt smile, she shakes out her arms but otherwise shows no signs of cold, only a puppyish eagerness to get in the water. Others here are of a similar mind. 80-year-old Mimi, who swims from the club every morning, grins at us as she strides purposefully down the wood-planked stairs to the water. Like Kim, she is outfitted simply in a cap, goggles, and a thin one-piece Lycra swimsuit. Wetsuits aren't exactly frowned upon here. The club encourages all comers, but swimmers are gently encouraged to do without. It still amazes Kim that she just happened to stumble into one of the best training grounds there is for what she does. At the time she began swimming with the club, though, she was just trying to survive. The treatment for her leg injury, a blunt force trauma that caused a catastrophic buildup of pressure inside one of her leg compartments, required multiple surgeries to relieve pressure, as well as skin grafts, hyperbaric treatments, and a stint in the burn unit at San Francisco's St. Francis Hospital. 2 years later, she finally went back to work. "I was most worried about the scars," she tells me. "My gait was off. I couldn't go for a run. And I didn't feel like me." She hid her scars under long pants and wore dark shoes to camouflage the clunky orthotics she needed to support her stride. She remembered the freedom of being in the water as a child in New Zealand, so she worked up the courage to begin swimming at a local pool. In the evenings, because she didn't want people ogling her scars. Her first goal was to swim a mile. At first, her stroke was terrible. Kim's mentor, the entrepreneur and investor Vito Biella, an accomplished open water swimmer in his own right, would later say that when he first met her, she couldn't swim her way out of a paper bag with flippers on. One day, two swimmers in the pool asked her if she'd ever thought about swimming in the bay. Swimming in the bay? She wondered. Kim had been living in San Francisco since 1995, but she'd never heard of anyone swimming in the bay. On a crisp, 54-degree day in Aquatic Park in late 2009, Kim gave it a try. Despite the cold, she couldn't stop smiling the whole time. She joined the Dolphin Club the next month. She calls it a secret society of adventurers, populated by individuals of all ages and incomes. Sometimes it takes a while for her to recognize a fellow member on the street. "It's because they're wearing clothes for a change," she says. When Kim and I first meet, she is on the verge of turning 40. These days, she has no qualms about talking about her scars. She shows me her right leg. Neat tracks, circumscribing the skin graft that was taken from her upper thigh to repair the traumatized tissue around her calf. "The water has been my teacher. It is my sanctuary. You can have a shitty week, but then you come to the water and feel cleansed. You're naked. All the artifice is stripped away." I begin to understand that the scars are a map of how she rehabilitated her life. The morning of our first swim together, Kim claps her hands and hoots, the wordless sound a kind of blessing. "Ready?" she asks. We dive in and stroke our way toward Alcatraz. 5. The Water Cure. While posted in London in the 1750s, Benjamin Franklin swam daily in the Thames. The cold bath was a corrective much in vogue, and the scientist, inventor, and all-around Renaissance man was an avid skinny dipper for much of his long life. Brits at the time suffered from what one writer has called a mess of maladies: fevers, digestive complaints, melancholia, nervous tics, tremors, and even stupidity were the epidemics of the day. The new wonder drug prescribed for the nasty health effects of urban living? Cold seawater. And thus, the English seaside resort was born. Not for sun-worshipping or frolicking, but for dunking oneself in the cold miracle cure of the ocean. It was the collective baptism of a country. Back across the pond, water therapy became big business in 19th century America. Public distrust of the medical establishment led to the fervent adoption of the water cure for everything from broken bones to typhus. There was even a hydropathic medical school opened in New York City in 1851. By the outbreak of the Civil War, more than 200 water cure clinics were operating around the country, and a journal dedicated to the subject had tens of thousands of subscribers. Water cure patients sat in water, submerged themselves in water, stood underwater as it was poured over them, wore wet compresses, wrapped themselves in dripping sheets, and ate a meager diet washed down, of course, with water, writes one historian of the practices. It was water, water everywhere, mostly for immersion but sometimes to drink. The prescription of 8 glasses of water a day is a relic from this time. Cold water was proclaimed the sovereign remedy for every ailment. Dunk your head in it for a fever, sniff it for a nosebleed, take a cold mouth bath to cure yourself of the filthy habit of tobacco chewing and restore a healthy salivary flow. Swimming was critical to the water cure. In the 8-volume Hydropathic Encyclopedia, published circa 1851, The swimming bath is prescribed as health-preserving and hygienic for all persons, but also as eminently therapeutic in some forms of chronic disease. As I flip through the encyclopedia's 500-plus pages, I find its exhaustive discussions of river, sponge, and wave baths to be both mind-numbing and fascinating. Whether you were weak in the lungs from tuberculosis or suffering from chronic constipation, swimming would help. To strengthen and open up the lungs, to get those lax abdominal muscles going and, move things along. Pamphlets rain down on the public, prescribing saltwater swims for longevity. Our trust in water as a cure-all goes back to the ancients. Egyptian royals bathed in water laced with essential oils, and Chinese and Japanese traditions extolled the medicinal effects of thermal springs. The Greeks went deep in their examination of every type of water therapy. Euripides wrote that the sea restores men's health, with great personal gratitude, since he was allegedly cured of rabies with a near drowning in the ocean. Called the sailor's method, this combination of water and asphyxia was a celebrated ancient treatment for the disease. One symptom of rabies is hydrophobia, and it was thought that a timely application of water would cure it. Euripides notwithstanding, it did not prove to be an effective remedy. Hippocrates and Aristotle were big fans of hot seawater baths. Romans would soak in hot water pools, then hop into the frigidarium, a bracing cold water bath, to close the pores and leave bathers refreshed at the end of the regimen. For most of this history of immersing our bodies in water for wellness, proponents didn't know exactly what they were talking about when it came to why, but they knew what felt good. Kim Chambers doesn't know much about the murky history of the water cure, but she was desperate to recover after her injury. When she fell that day in 2007, she smacked her head on the ground and struck her leg on a big ceramic pot at the bottom of the stairs. "I have a really high pain tolerance," she tells me, "so I just thought it was going to be a nasty bruise." She managed to drive to work, her leg ballooning to nearly double its normal size. At the office, she collapsed. At the hospital, surgeons sliced open her leg in two places to relieve the swelling that was destroying her nerves. She didn't wake up until post-surgery, when her doctors reported the grim news that she might never walk again. What does despair look like? Feel like? It looks like angry red scars. It feels like shame. The urgent desire to hide a limp. It feels like desperation. It is the opposite, then, of the unfettered joy of a child swimming at the beach. That joy is what Kim was after when she made herself go to the pool. Being a patient gets old after a while. 2 years of doctor's appointments, pain meds, full-time physical therapy. On the morning she swam for the first time in San Francisco Bay, what she finally found was a glimpse of an alternate reality. "Not a lot of people have video footage of their rebirth," Kim says, "but I do. The guys I was swimming with filmed me, this shivering, skinny, broken woman who was 120 pounds soaking wet, but I had the biggest shit-eating grin on my face that they'd ever seen." It occurs to me that religious people who find God, of course, do have videos of their rebirth. They are born again, oftentimes in water, with a baptism. After Kim started swimming in the cold waters of the bay, she noticed a change in her severely nerve-damaged right leg. It had more feeling in it. She had a theory that she ran by her physicians in those early days. "All the blood is sucked from your extremities to protect your organs when you get in that cold water," she explains, in her lilting New Zealand accent during one of our marathon phone calls after work one evening. When she's not training or traveling the world for swims, she has until recently been working as a director of community engagement for Adobe, the software company. Couldn't it be possible that when the blood rushes back into those extremities after you warm up again, that you're getting a kind of oxygen therapy, that there's a higher rate of it being flushed around your body? Her doctor said they could see the validity in it. With oxygen circulating at a much faster rate than if Kim were sedentary or even exercising on land. The result? Her nerves were regenerating at a swifter pace relative to that of the previous 2 years, To tease apart the tangle of truth and myth around water, I call up Dr. Hirofumi Tanaka, Director of the Cardiovascular Aging Research Laboratory and Professor of Kinesiology at the University of Texas. He studies how our bodies move, heal, and age. By virtue of his work and his upbringing, in the string of islands that is Japan, where learning to swim is required of all school children, Tanaka is an effusive, enthusiastic proponent of swimming for health. Tanaka's lab has pioneered new research on swimming's effect on two of the biggest hallmarks of aging, high blood pressure and arthritis. Over the last 4 or 5 years, a funky thing happened. We realized that the effects of swimming actually surpassed the magnitude of the effects of walking or cycling, he tells me. None of us knew that before. Average reduction in blood pressure after land-based exercise training is 5 to 7 points. Swimming, he found, reduces blood pressure by an average of 9 points. In the blood pressure world, that's significant. It also decreases arterial stiffness, a condition in which the walls of your arteries become less elastic and add strain to the heart muscle. The pressure of water itself on your body plays a part in swimming for health. When you immerse yourself in water, it pushes blood away from the extremities and toward your heart and lungs. This temporarily elevates your blood pressure and makes your heart and lungs work harder. The process builds efficiency and endurance in the cardiovascular system, leading to lower blood pressure over time. And when you swim, the water provides gentle, all-around resistance for your muscles to work against. There's an element of agelessness to swimming, Tanaka says. More bodies can do this, and for longer. In Japan, a nation of old people, swimming is hugely popular. There is even a subset of Japanese manga or comic books dedicated to swimming. Tanaka loves to go up to the top of Tokyo Skytree. At 2,080 feet, it's the tallest tower in the world. Because on a clear day, you can look down and see all the swimming pools glinting on the city's rooftops. Swimming had always been assumed to be a good treatment for arthritis, but there was no science to back it up. In 2016, Tanaka and his co-researchers published a paper that provided a definitive yes. If you look at patients with arthritis, the major issues are pain and function, Tanaka says. They suffer from chronic pain on a daily basis. After swimming training, the pain levels went down substantially. And even though the patients were in water, the functions we assessed on land, walking, standing from a chair, improved substantially. Swimming is the best exercise we can prescribe because it stimulates mobility without pain and circulation. The swimming studies were done in cool water pools, that is, regular swimming pools, which are typically 80 degrees and below. So Kim Chambers' instinct was right. Swimming in cool water every day boosted her vascular function, the healthy circulation of blood around the body to the damaged parts that needed it, even more than running or cycling would have, and perhaps, most important, without the pain. If I don't swim, the pain grows. If I'm in more pain, what will become of my life? In an essay on living with chronic pain, the writer Melissa Hung describes a swim as a daily act of endurance. In the years since a headache has taken up permanent residence inside her skull, the pool is the place where pain leaves center stage, if only briefly. It's where she finds momentary relief from a body that will not behave. Swimming hurts, but not swimming hurts more. President Franklin D. Roosevelt suffered from polio. While in office, he had a swimming pool installed in the White House and swam for therapy several times a day. President John F. Kennedy, who endured near-constant back pain and a life of excruciating health miseries, loved the pool so much he swam before lunch and dinner. FDR's pool remains there today, beneath what is the press pool briefing room. Buoyancy, floating, weightlessness, freedom. These are the words we use to talk about swimming. Is it a coincidence that this is also the language we use to talk about the lightness of being, the wellness of being, that we strive for in this corporeal world? Downstairs at the Dolphin Club, between the boathouse and the front stairway entrance, there's a quote from Henry David Thoreau's Walden, posted on the wall. Renew thyself completely each day. Do it again, and again, and forever again. You do renew yourself every time you're out there, Kim tells me one day, as we look out at the bay from the upstairs window of the boathouse. Over the course of the winter and spring, we continue to meet up periodically for swims. On this particular morning, it's proving to be a stormy start and the water is turbulent. We all have bad days, and heartache and heartbreak, but you submerge yourself in that water and it's like pressing the reset button. It has given me tremendous clarity. Each time she gets in, it's as if the water reflects how she feels and responds in kind. That's why I have to do it every day. Swimming from the Farallon Islands, 30 miles out in the Pacific, was for Kim the ultimate extension of how being in deep water could force a kind of surrender. As she likes to put it, the 5-mile radius around the islands is the great white shark's living room. She's just a visitor, passing through. After her record-breaking swims as part of the first all-female relay team from the Farallons and then as the first solo woman, despite the danger, she would swim there every day if she could. She sometimes takes a weekend jaunt out to the islands, just to swim. All of my senses are ignited, she says. I can smell the sea life. That feeling of being in water that's 6,000 or 10,000 feet deep, and you're just this tiny person swimming on the surface. Entrepreneur Vito Biella has described swimming at the Farallons as akin to being in heaven and talking to the devil at the same time. The restlessness of the seascape, Kim says, is captivating for her. You don't know what's swimming underneath you. The seals all around, and the birds. You know you're not supposed to be there, and a shark could come out of nowhere. It's tantalizing to be on that edge, to be that connected. Before her accident, Kim was a self-described control freak about her body, about her appearance, about her weight. She had a job in Silicon Valley with long hours and good money. I was a superficial person, she says. I was classically trained as a ballerina, and everything in my worldview was very disciplined. Learning to swim meant learning how to relinquish control, to thrive in a space of uncertainty. She works hard to prepare for each big swim, but she now finds nothing more exhilarating than jumping in and not knowing what will come. We live a life on land, and we think we know what's going to happen, she tells me, but we don't. And I've learned how to surrender. It's so freeing and so scary, but you feel like this modern-day explorer. Not many people have gotten into the water in the Farallons. You're like an astronaut out there. In 2016, Kim was inducted into the Explorers Club, which includes among its members astronauts and explorers, including Sir Edmund Hillary, Tenzing Norgay, Sylvia Earle, Neil Armstrong, Sally Ride, Thor Heyerdahl, and Jane Goodall. During the course of our morning swims, I learn from Kim that the daily swim in the bay is where she confronts her demons. Then she shakes their hands. 10 years ago, she was someone who wasn't supposed to walk again, and yet here she is, a multiple world record holder in a discipline that, back then, she didn't even know existed. It's human nature to resist doing things that are uncomfortable for us. But she finds something extraordinary in pushing through the discomfort to see what's on the other side. One fall, I decided to swim from Alcatraz to San Francisco. I did it on a dare. What I remember most about a nighttime tour I took once of the island prison is the fact that, given the nearness of Alcatraz to downtown San Francisco, inmates were often haunted by the sounds of life across the water. When city residents held New Year's Eve parties and their reveling carried across the cold, current-roiled bay, the shore seemed maddeningly close to the prisoners. It was the ultimate torture, that of proximity. Alcatraz's barren, craggy island is less than a square mile in area. Everywhere there are astounding views of San Francisco, the expansive bay, and the rust-hued Golden Gate Bridge. Ohlone oral history tells us that Alcatraz was used by the indigenous people as a place of isolation, to punish those who violated tribal law. When you are there, especially at night, you understand. It makes sense that you would feel small anchored in a place so big. In the nearly three decades that Alcatraz, known as the Rock, was a functioning federal prison, from 1934 to 1963, when it closed due to the skyrocketing costs of having to bring in everything by boat, including fresh water, it held high-risk prisoners, including Al Capone, Robert Stroud, a.k.a. the Birdman of Alcatraz, so-called because he became a respected ornithologist during his earlier incarceration at Leavenworth Penitentiary, and Roy Gardner, the great American train robber and the most notorious escape artist of his time. Transferred to Alcatraz in 1934, Gardner successfully appealed for clemency and was released in July 1938. The next year, he published a sensational autobiography. He named the book after the place that marked him, Alcatraz. In another year, he would be dead by suicide. The Rock is a place that can drive you mad. As a prison, it had a storied menace. It was designed to break you into submission. All in all, there were 14 separate documented escape attempts involving 36 prisoners. Of these, the most infamous and exhaustively planned attempt was that of Frank Morris and the Anglin brothers in June 1962. They tunneled out of their cells using sharpened spoons. In their beds, they left blankets and dummy heads constructed out of soap, toilet paper, and their own hair. In the dead of night, they entered the water in an inflated raft made from 50 stolen raincoats. The three men were never found, but a recent study using computer modeling and historical tide information from that date shows a very narrow window of opportunity in which they could have avoided being sucked out to sea. It is possible that they were able to get out of the water in the headlands north of the Golden Gate Bridge. Debris from this landing would likely have washed up on Angel Island after the tide returned. And this, in fact, was where the FBI found a paddle and personal items linked to the men. Still, the most probable outcome was hypothermia and drowning. One inmate, John Paul Scott, succeeded in swimming from the island to Fort Point on the southern end of the Golden Gate Bridge in December 1962. Scott's was the only confirmed case of a prisoner reaching the shore by swimming. The water temperature, typically below 60 degrees, vicious currents, often moving at 6 knots or faster, sharp-edged rocks that could slice you into ribbons, and sharks, enough said, were believed to make the task futile. Scott proved it wasn't. He and another prisoner had fashioned water wings from stolen rubber gloves. The two worked on kitchen duty. Scott's co-conspirator broke his ankle during the prison break and was captured within minutes. Scott ended up beached at Fort Point during an ebb tide and was found unconscious, suffering from hypothermia, by four teenagers. After a brief stay at the Presidio Hospital, he was taken back to Alcatraz. Surely it says something about our collective beliefs that we choose to put a maximum security federal prison on a speck of land barely a mile and a half offshore from San Francisco. We build jails like Rikers Island, sandwiched between the Bronx and Queens and within shouting distance of the runways at New York's LaGuardia Airport, and prisons like Alcatraz tantalizingly close to our cities, and we believe them to be secure because of the water surrounding them. But swimmers on the outside had been testing the waters around Alcatraz since at least the 1920s. Prior to its conversion to a federal prison, Alcatraz was used by the military both as a fortification and as a detention center. Confederate POWs were housed there early in the American Civil War. In 1933, the year before Alcatraz opened as a federal penitentiary, 17-year-old Anastasia Scott, no relation to the prisoner John Paul, whose father was a sergeant stationed on the island, swam from Alcatraz to San Francisco in 43 minutes, accompanied by a rowboat. She was the first woman on record to make the swim. Two other San Francisco swimmers, Doris McLeod and Gloria Sigliano, followed shortly thereafter to protest the decision to turn the island into a federal prison. McLeod completed a two-way crossing in 2 hours. All three women were excellent swimmers with knowledge of the tide conditions. Also critical to their success, of course, was the fact that they were not required to escape under cover of darkness or to subsist on a prison diet with little to no exercise. For our swim from the rock, my friend Steve and I took up training in the waters around Aquatic Park, the endpoint for most Alcatraz swims. From this spot, you can venture into the open bay and get a feel for the strength of the currents. The first time we swam there, I experienced a queasy discomfort. It started with a tightness in my chest and a genuine anxiety of the kind I had not felt for years when it came to swimming. My breath did not come easy. I did not know if I should attribute that to the cold, which felt unexpectedly crushing, or to the wetsuit, which felt unexpectedly confining. Steve smiled widely at me when we took a break to tread water and check in with each other. "Relax," he said when he saw my face, "and breathe." By the morning of the swim itself, I had tried to prepare myself for the cold, and I was familiar with the way the bay's current pulls you with the unnerving speed toward the open ocean on an outgoing tide. I knew that container ships could seem far away, but come upon you in a matter of seconds. Our boat pilot, Gary Emick, was an open water swimming legend who would go on to break a world record with his 1,000th swim from Alcatraz to San Francisco. I had conditioned myself to follow Steve's advice. Relax and breathe. There were six of us swimming that day. The water temperature was 57 degrees, the surface chopped with a light wind. We arrived at Alcatraz before 9 a.m. and jumped in on a flood tide. The chilly water had a bite that managed to steal my first breath away. We regrouped for one last wave at our boat and its pilot. In photos from that morning, I am smiling. I look warmer than I felt, the sun glinting silver on my reflective goggles. We turned for the city and swam. As I stroked through the water, I fell into a rhythm, and suddenly the swim didn't feel like a fight. There was an ease, a comforting regularity to each round of breath, stroke, stroke, breath. We were prepared for it. The tight band that squeezed my chest upon entry loosened, and I began to greet the periodic cresting wave with aplomb instead of anxiety, skirting each rise of foam with an enthusiastic and carefully timed frog kick. Other than the occasional rogue seaweed tangle, we managed to avoid any undesirable or hazardous run-ins with marine life. Alas, sea lions' bites have recently become a thing there. The unusual fisheye angle to the Golden Gate Bridge and to Alcatraz were reminders of the rarefied club in which we were earning membership. The 45 minutes passed swiftly, and suddenly we arrived at Aquatic Park. Emick proclaimed it an excellent time. 6. Seawater in our veins. Get in the ocean every day, and your body will calibrate itself to the medium's moods, rhythms, temperatures. At 53 degrees, you get the ice cream headache. At 50 degrees, the bones in your wrists ache. On any given day, Kim and her fellow dolphin clubbers and Southenders can call the water temperature to within a degree, just by feel. "What do you think it was today?" 59? She wonders aloud to me in the water one day. When I ask why she thinks so, she says it's because it feels wonderful. Yeah, I would bet a lot of money on that. It's not quite 60. Let's swim over and check the thermometer. She's right, of course. Human fetuses inhale and exhale amniotic fluid in utero, helping to form the lungs. We have so-called gill slits that become parts of our jaws and respiratory tracts, the form of which are evolutionary relics of aquatic, gill-breathing vertebrates. Seawater is so similar in mineral content to human blood plasma that our white blood cells can survive and function in it for some time. I delight in my mental picture of this, the not-so-fanciful notion that we have seawater circulating in our veins. Since Guthlauger's involuntary plunge into the sea more than 3 decades ago, science has been introduced to other humans with unusual adaptive abilities in extremely cold water. There's Lynn Cox, the legendary open water swimmer who was the first to swim the Bering Strait. She swam from Alaska to the Soviet Union in 1987 in water that dropped as low as 38 degrees. The headline in the New York Times read, "Long, Cold Swim." Her reception was reported thusly. It was a simple seaside picnic, a genteel tea party on the beach, but to get there took some doing for the guest of honor. The following year, Guðlaugur and Cox appeared in the same academic journal in a scholarly brief about the potential for Arctic swims to become a sport. In 2002, Cox swam more than a mile in 32-degree water in Antarctica. She was the first person ever to do so. In 2007, she swam in Disko Bay, Greenland, in water that was below 27 degrees. The average American woman has a body fat percentage that ranges between 22 and 25%. Cox's body fat has been estimated at 35%. More significantly, it is very evenly distributed around her body. In addition to keeping her warm, this internal wetsuit provides her with neutral buoyancy in seawater, which means she can expend very little energy to maintain optimal swimming position in the ocean. Like Guðlaugur, Cox has participated in medical studies, opening researchers' eyes to new ways to treat multiple sclerosis. Cold water swimming can dramatically reduce spasticity for a number of hours following immersion, and to improve hospital procedures around heart, spinal, and brain injuries. Cooling the body can reduce swelling and trauma. By studying the specifics of blood flow into Cox's hand while it was immersed in cold water, for example, doctors learned how to better plan for surgeries. Scientists also found that with immersion in cold water, Cox's core body temperature actually goes up. See what she can do when she enters a cold water jacuzzi. In 2 minutes, her body heat warms the water by 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Guðlaugur has not undergone this kind of testing. And there's the British South African swimmer, Lewis Pugh, who is nicknamed the Sir Edmund Hillary of swimming. He has swum in the Arctic, in a meltwater lake on Mount Everest, and in Antarctica's Ross Sea. Scientists studying Pugh have found that his core body temperature rises even before he hits the water, reaching temperatures as high as 101 degrees Fahrenheit. Professor Tim Noakes, a sports physiologist from the University of Cape Town, South Africa, first noted this response. In The Lancet, he called it anticipatory thermogenesis, the creation of heat before an event. It's Pugh's Pavlovian response from years of cold water conditioning. As for the rest of us, what happens to our bodies in cold water? I ask Hirofumi Tanaka, the longevity researcher, if there are any long-term studies of cold water swimming and health. We know the response, the diving reflex, when you put your face in cold water. The blood vessels in your skin constrict and your heart rate drops like crazy, he says. But we don't have a lot of research in terms of chronic exposure to exercise in the cold. Then he tells me about the AMA. A couple of years ago, Tanaka went back to Japan to study the AMA, the legendary female freedivers of Japan and Korea. AMA is Japanese for Women of the Sea. Carrying on this region's more than 2,000-year-old tradition of hunting for shellfish, the women begin diving at age 13 or 14. The group Tanaka studied was composed of 65-year-olds on average. Like the Mokan Sea nomads of Southeast Asia, the AMA pass on their skills and knowledge about the importance of the sea in stories told over generations. As with the Mokan children, the practice of diving for shellfish changes their physical bodies too. They dive up to 200 times a day, every day, year-round. When it comes to vascular function, Tanaka says, they are sky-high. The AMA are exposed to the diving reflex on a daily basis, hundreds of times a day. Tanaka had wondered if the AMA's arterial structure and function had adapted to resemble that seen in other diving mammals. He found that the women had significantly lower heart rates and less arterial stiffness when compared to other adults living in the same fishing village. They did, however, suffer from hearing loss. 50 years of exposure to cold water has adverse effects, too. The scientific picture is far from complete, but there's a growing body of research on the therapeutic benefits of immersing ourselves in water. Warm water immersion has its perks, too. Studies show that 1 hour head-out immersion in 90-degree water lowers heart rate and blood pressure, promoting relaxation. But immersion in 57-degree water for the same period boosts the metabolic rate by 350% and dopamine by 250%. And when it comes to actually swimming in that water, other research shows that regular cold water winter swimming significantly reduces tension, fatigue, and pain among participants and improves general well-being. I need to look no further than the Dolphin Club's own archives for convincing snapshots of swimming health. Back in 1974, Jack LaLanne, he of the famed fitness empire, swam while towing a rowboat behind him from Alcatraz to the club in less than 90 minutes, all with his legs shackled and his arms manacled. In a black and white photo from that day, the astonishingly robust LaLanne holds up his handcuffed and well-muscled wrists in triumph as he nears Aquatic Park. He was 60 years old. When LaLanne was 70, shackled and manacled again, he swam a mile and a half in Long Beach Harbor, towing 70 boats with 70 passengers. LaLanne swam every day. No surprise, then, that he was made an honorary lifetime member of the Dolphin.